Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, your guide to what's good in pop culture. Every week, Jesse Thorne interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at iTunes under Podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we talk about one of our favorite recent arrivals on television, the CW's telenovela-inspired Jane the Virgin. Then we catch up with a movie that is surprisingly not a comedy, the Jennifer Lopez thriller, The Boy Next Door. We'll talk about where it fits into the larger picture of bad idea sex movies and whether its spectacular trailer really does it justice. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us from the West Coast all the way out at NPR in California, Barry Hardiman. Barry Hardiman, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor at NPR's Weekend Edition and a fan of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Well, we are a fan of you, Barry, and we are always so very happy to have you with us. We had, as you know, our friend Margaret Willison with you last week, and we enjoy you and Margaret together, but now we are running.
I enjoy us together, too.
A Margaret episode and a Barry episode back to back.
Yay. It's almost like we're together.
So one of the reasons why we invited Barry is that she came up on our list of folks who are interested in Jane the Virgin. Now, Jane the Virgin started in the fall of 2014 on the CW. It's an hour-long, what would you call it, a comedic drama, dramatic comedy, both sort of is a telenovela and is sending up telenovelas. It's in that kind of enchanted genre where you both are doing the thing and sending up the thing.
If you want more of a plot description for this show, all you have to do is watch the first 30 seconds of any episode of it, and it will tell you the complete story.
Hola, it's me again. Let's review. By now, you all know the deal. Jane was accidentally artificially inseminated.
But I've never had sex!
You know who wasn't thrilled with this development? Jane's detective boyfriend, Michael.
Ross, don't have this baby.
But Jane decided to have it.
In the voice of the wonderful narrator, who
oh
I think
God. Oh my God,
is,
I love him so much.
Right, the narrator on Jane the Virgin is pretty much the best character on television.
The credits call him the Latin lover narrator.
Yeah.
And you know, actually, I am usually not a person who likes voiceover, and I love this so much. I love it. It's like, it's one of my favorite things about the scene.
But it's teasing the notion of voiceover. You know, it is important to
which
know.
Which is why I
it
like
it. It is not important to know, but it is important to know. It is important for her to know, but she doesn't know. They do like lots and lots and lots of that in a way that I found instantly charming. I mean, I was hooked on this show in about the first 40 seconds.
Yeah, so. and they similarly type words on the screen to explain who people are. And some of that is for comedy, and some of that is just
for
to
actual
help
exposition.
You keep up with this crazy story.
Because it is as complicated as a telenovela.
Right. It is the constant, ceaseless churning of plot, of event upon event. here's the plot of tonight's episode. Crazy crap happens. And then, so if you're looking for a nuanced character study, you know, this isn't it. I mean, it is grounded by the performance of Gina Rodriguez, striking this great balance between the character is idealistic but not naive.
Right.
She is open and warm, but she's intelligent, which is not something you see a lot, especially in telenovelas, which tend to push people to very, very broad types.
Right.
Yeah. And she could be annoying. She feels so real. I mean, I remember the second episode where she starts crying after she's seen the sonogram. I felt very moved by it, even though this is essentially kind of a campy, sort of silly show, but it's got such a warm beating heart in the form, really, of Gina Rodriguez.
I wrote down warm beating heart next to the words Gina Rodriguez in my notes. And she is so crucial to the enjoyment of this show. It is shows of this type, your big, soapy, revenge type shows, are very often pitting pitting varying degrees of nasty people against each other. Yes. And while there are most definitely nasty scenery chewing people on this show, chewing scenery nastily, there are also like all of these people who are just goobers. They introduce, and it's one of my favorite little flourishes in the show. She doesn't know yet that her father is actually the star of the big telenovela, who starts out as just a purely fictional construct and then actually is woven into her life. He is just this ridiculous, self-infatuated buffoon, but he's lovable at the same time.
So she
is definitely the conscience of the show. She is the moral center of the show. Mm-hmm. And yet there are other decent people.
Oh, well,
lots of them.
A lot of this show does have her involved with a couple of different guys, but it is very much built about her relationships with her mother and her grandmother. Mm-hmm. You know, these three generations of the women in this family who have these really close relationships and love each other very much and rely on each other very much. You know, not for nothing, but this is also a show where you get to hear a bunch of people speak Spanish to each other, which the show does not replace with English. There are times when they speak English to each other, but at times when they might most logically speak Spanish to each other, it shows them speaking Spanish to each other, because that way you don't get another layer of kind of artificiality.
Right. In a really smart move, the pilot had the grandmother speaking in English, but then as soon as the pilot was done, she goes back most of the
time
Spanish with English subtitles. Yeah. Really smart.
When they presented this show at Press Tour last July, I give the critics at that thing a lot of credit for the fact that people were pretty instantly taken with this show. I actually asked the question because in the pilot that we saw, the version that we saw, she spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. But in the sizzle reel, the advertising sizzle reel, in the same moment, she spoke English.
Right.
And it was clear that they were very conscious of, they want that to be part of the show, but they don't necessarily want people to feel like they're going to constantly be looking at subtitles. And so it was clear that they were walking a line there. Now, the top line out of that Press Tour session was everybody was instantly in love with Gina Rodriguez, who gave this wonderful, you know, went into this wonderful speech about how she turned down a role on the show Devious Maids. Because she basically said, you know, look, I mean, she came as close as you'll ever see an actor come to naming a specific show and saying, I wanted better for myself than that.
Now, the show is set in Miami. Miami's about 35% Cuban, but they're playing it very close to the chest with exactly where they are. She's Latina.
Well,
capital L.
There is a moment in one of the very recent episodes where they suggest it's Venezuela.
Okay. All right.
But you're right. That is not a major element to specify it in that way.
Now, if you watch the show with somebody who lived in Miami through most of their adolescence and early childhood, you get an extra layer. Mm-hmm. That layer is a lot of cursing because it's like, look at that arid palm tree, he might say. Or look at that. They think that's Coconut Grove. That's not Coconut Grove. That's Long Beach, California. Or this is just Dexter all over again. Look, Burn Notice filmed in Miami. Why can't Dexter? But I have seen some carping online about how, you know, no straight man wears shirts this tight. And I want to say, that's the one thing they got right about Miami.
Okay, so speaking of men, the basic setup of Jane the Virgin, which comes out in about the first 20 minutes of the pilot, she is a virgin, she goes to the gynecologist, and she's accidentally inseminated instead of given a pap smear, because you know how that can happen. And so you have her in contact with both her fiancé, whose name is Michael, and Raphael, who is the guy whose product she is inseminated with.
It's actually conditioner.
It's a tough economy. So she winds up in this very, as you can imagine, unusual situation where she is pregnant, but she is a virgin. One of the things that's interesting, Stephen talked about kind of how there are a lot of decent people in this show. Mm-hmm. I have always been a Raphael person. I always have responded much more to him, and I've always felt like he was much more attractive to me. It's partly just a type thing, I guess. But I was very surprised to find out that there are hardline Michael partisans. I just assumed everyone was a Raphael person.
I'm sorry to ruin the diversity of this panel on that, but I'm a Raphael gal myself. Because I like the emotionally, like, damaged, vulnerable, hunky yeah. kind of dude. It's you know, true. And I like tall, dark, and handsome. So.
Well, could I just go to bat mm-hmm. for neither of them?
Yeah. Good. Go
was,
for it.
You can.
That was kind of my initial thing. Is I'm like, well, part of it is they do a nice job of allowing it to unfold. The extent to which you should trust either of these dudes, mm-hmm. they establish up front yeah. that Michael is not necessarily everything that he's right. cracked up to be. They're very clear that Raphael, especially at first, is not everything mm-hmm. that you might want him to be.
I might want him to be, is what you're saying. I get it.
And
get
so,
it.
So ultimately, I just think she should just go for plan C.
Yeah.
It's
you know,
about her.
I've been watching Justin Baldoni, his career, since he exploded onto our screens in 2005 in Spring Break Shark Attack.
Which one is he?
Raphael.
He's Raphael.
Yeah.
And he has trouble fitting into his shirts. Now, did either of you guys watch Ugly Betty? Did any of you people mm-hmm. watch
it? I did. I watched a fair amount of Ugly Betty.
All right. Yeah. I was talking about this show over the weekend with some friends, and they were saying, the thing is that every episode has plot, big, mm-hmm. huge thing that happens, plus a lot mm-hmm. of filler. And on Ugly Betty, that filler was Michael Urie being catty and lots of sniping, jokes, in other words, right. jokes. And here, mm-hmm. it's not dialogue wit. It's what you guys were talking about before, heart and sweetness.
Right.
Is that approximately right? Does that
I think to a certain extent, I was surprised. I watched several episodes at work, as one does, and found myself occasionally like swallowing back like a cackle. Like I would suddenly mm-hmm. like try not to laugh out loud at a show that I don't think of as having a ton of jokes, but it's very nice at pacing its situations mm-hmm. in ways that made me laugh more than I would have necessarily expected to.
There's also a lot of humor that comes from the show's playing around with form, both mm-hmm. the narrator, the captioning, mm-hmm. the way they like to poke fun at the rhythm of the show
yeah.
while still doing it. Right. There is a having your cake and eating it too totally. Thing that happens with this mm-hmm. show where they're making fun of themselves for being this very...
For being so heavily expositional.
Well, right. And also being this very, as Glenn said, plot, driven kind of, you know, festival of nuttiness. Mm-hmm. And yet they're still doing it.
Right.
And so they get to both be the thing... and also make fun of the thing, you know?
Yeah.
So one of the things that I thought was very interesting is this past episode addressed immigration in a very overt way. And it did it in an episode in which was one of the more, it was much more religion heavy. I mean,
yes.
there is, obviously they're Catholic, but this episode was particularly heavy where you have Jane going to retrieve her rosary. And so you kind of have these two different behaviors. One is this kind of prayer, and which is a sort of maybe something we think of as more of a conservative thing. And then you also have this other issue of immigration reform. And instead of sort of being in the same boxes that you normally would, like, they're not in the typical conservative liberal boxes.
I think that's right. No, I think that's
right. And so it's getting to sort of have its cake and eat it too with these issues as well of being a show that is delightful, but is also addressing this particular issue that is real, but is also still filled with whimsy. And so you don't actually wonder why any of the characters are doing what they do. That stuff seems real, even though it is a fully whimsical world.
I think you raise an interesting point, which is, of the many kinds of diversity that this mm-hmm. show helps to increase, and diversity has become one of those very difficult mm-hmm. words that's, you know, hard to define what it means to different people, and it becomes mm-hmm. a word that sort of doesn't mm-hmm. mean anything unless you specify. But in addition to being a show that features, you know, for example, a young Latina heroine, which is not mm-hmm. common on television, among the kinds of things that I think this show serves that aren't always well served is that this is a family to whom religion is very important. And although, mm-hmm. like everything on the show, there is a sense of humor about that. There is mm-hmm. a sense of humor about aspects of being Catholic, just like mm-hmm. there is aspects of anything else. But their religion remains a central thing to them, yeah. and it is yeah. not made fun of. No, that in and of itself is not used for comedy, and it's not used to delegitimize the things that they're saying. And so I yeah. think, you know, there are a bunch of ways in which you don't get a lot of characters like this on English language American television. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is one of them.
One of the things that sets telenovelas apart, one of the many things, is that they only run for a few months. They have a beginning, middle, and end. So even though there is this churn of plot and there's all these reversals and alliances form and then dissolve and then they're back the next day, mm-hmm. it does end. Jane the Virgin has just been picked up for a next season, and it's going to go on for as long as it goes on. Mm-hmm. And yet the churning of these characters through all the back and forth that they're going through is just going to keep going. And at some point, she's going to have the kid. Mm-hmm. At the rate they're going, I think we're only like a day after somebody was murdered, and everybody's like, yep, whatever. Uh-huh. It's just long-term consequences. It isn't what this particular show is about.
Right.
Yeah. And yet it's going to have to address that.
I found the sudden murderiness of it a little surprising, because for a while it is such a chewy little fun confection. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it gets bigger and grander, mm-hmm. and soapier, and the stakes get bigger and wilder,
right.
and crazier. Mm-hmm. And yet it maintains that fizzy quality to it. Mm-hmm. You, Glenn, said something interesting, and I want to push back against a little bit. You were saying that there's an enormous amount of heart in this show.
Sure.
That is a big part of it. Do you like it anyway?
I do. I do think it's really engaging, light, and frothy. And when it's sitting there on my DVR, and it's like, what do you want to watch tonight? I'll think to myself, I'll just remember all those heart-tugging parts, and I'll be like, eh, maybe not. But then I will remember Rogelio. Anything that Rogelio does. And I like that they are...
That is the father.
The father who is a giant telenovela star.
Who is very, very funny. And I like that they're using him sparingly. I think the little of that guy goes a long way. As soon as we start to make it more... This is another reason I'm worried about where the series goes. Because if it becomes the Rogelio show, then there's that...
He gets a little Urkel-y.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He will get little Urkel-y.
And it must be so tempting to do that. Because he's so funny.
Yeah. You know what is one thing about it that I have to say that I think I haven't seen in a show that I liked this much in a long time is it appears to have no cynicism.
Mm. Right.
I mean, and if there's nothing coming back to bite you. Mm. And that is such a relief because I watch so much HBO. You know, like I watch so much, I see so much stuff on television about how terrible the world is that it is sometimes really just such a lovely break to say, wouldn't it be nice to see a group of like basically decent people and then some really funny villains doing some stuff? That gives me that Gilmore Girls feeling of like,
I think Gilmore Girls is a great comparison, despite the fact that it had a different kind of stylized form.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it feels
similar to me.
There's
for
a
some
lot.
Reason.
I think there's a lot to that comparison, which has never occurred to me before. But I'll take it.
And if the show could also include, Terry from Three's Company in a wheelchair doing a Boris Badenov accent,
that's true.
More is the pleasure.
Sold.
Bring it on.
Bring it on, indeed.
This show does fit into that pop culture comfort food.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Slot that we've talked
about
before.
Yes, it does. Yes.
And it's weird because obviously it's very, very different from Parks and Rec. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But it has a little, it feels a little bit of that same, this is just a warm, sweet show. Like if Parks and Rec had occasional murder.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Yeah. I think you're right. Well, we are fans of this show, and undoubtedly some of you are fans of this show as well. We would love to hear from you about it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/monkeysee. So, next on the agenda, a couple of weeks ago,
oh boy,
I wrote a post on the blog on Monkey See about the trailer for the Jennifer Lopez movie, The Boy Next Door.
And I want to point out that this piece you wrote on the trailer for the movie The Boy Next Door got more traffic on NPR.org than last year's Austin 100.
It was...
which I spent 2 months killing myself over.
Yeah, probably.
How long did it take you to write The Boy Next Door?
It was a list.
Maybe half an hour.
Was it not a list?
Yeah.
Maybe half an hour. Yeah.
Yep.
It did well for me.
It did well for me.
So the movie The Boy Next Door is about Jennifer Lopez as a high school teacher, classics teacher in a high school, because you know how they all have classics.
It means she's easily seduced by reading.
It's true.
Right. I know that problem.
She is the steamy, often damp high school teacher who meets a younger, but frankly, according to his IMDb profile, not that young.
No, I'm sorry. She is 45 and looks 30.
Yeah.
He is 27 playing 19 and looks 34.
Yeah.
Which it makes it very confusing.
There's some truth
right.
to that.
There's good shimmer makeup.
Right. So she meets this young dude who is in the movie, is 19, and lives next door.
There you go. Right there.
And they have a little dalliance. This is all in the trailer. They have a little dalliance, and then he becomes a crazy murderer. So,
as one does.
So yep. We talked about whether we were going to address ourselves to this movie. Now, I did go to see it. I did.
Oh, you did?
Yes. And Stephen went to see it, and so did Glenn.
We did tell Barry
that seeing the movie was not mandatory. Because otherwise,
we failed her.
Why would she be here?
Well, it wouldn't have been fun without you guys.
Right. So that's okay. That's the right advice.
So, Glenn, how did you enjoy The Boy Next Door?
If you have seen the trailer for this film, and if you have read Linda's amazing post, you have had the optimal experience with this film.
That is not true.
I win.
I think it's true.
The two hemi, semi, demi jokes in this film are both in the same scene. They're both in the trailer. Yeah. A, I love your mom's cookies. B, it got real wet here last night.
It got real wet last night.
Yep. This film was not even copy edited. How do I know this script? Yeah. Because at some point, somebody says, I will never, ever gonna let you go. Come on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Spend some time.
Yeah.
Look, hire a proofreader. I guess
there are unforced errors.
Oh my god.
I know, Glenn, that you are a jokes guy, but this is not a jokes movie.
It's a line movie. It has to make a certain amount of sense.
This is a slickened up, goried up Lifetime movie. There's a family of Lifetime movies that are all like, they met online. Mm. And like, so she dates the guy and he's obviously creepy because of his hairstyle and his face and you know. And then eventually like she has like a secondary best friend who is either imperiled or killed. Mm-hmm. And eventually it resolves.
Yep.
And you see them all the time and they star, you know, the fourth lead from Party of Five.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And this is just like a version of that. That cost like $3 million instead of $300.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I really fear that the success of this movie, because this movie did really well for how much it cost.
For how much it cost.
Means we're going to get just like a whole bunch of these things.
Because she is a classics teacher, the two actors are forced to mouth dialogue that is not actually intelligent, but is Hollywood intelligent about classical epic Greek poetry.
Yeah.
And it's like watching two dogs stand on their hind legs and walk around because it's like, oh, it's adorable. But you can see the effort.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you want it to stop so they can relax.
I can't believe that I'm going to take this position, but I actually think you're underselling this movie.
All right.
Okay. I got a couple things to say. First of all, when you say the movie gets gory, it gets creatively gory.
Yeah.
The violence in this movie.
The C word, really?
The violence in this movie is not the violence that you have seen a million times. I put my sweater over my head because this movie has a way of understanding that it's not necessarily just the big impact of the violence. You want to find something about which people get really squeamish and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And there is some of that in this movie. And I admired how they just absolutely went for it. Okay. There's that. I have to stand up for the sex scene in this movie for one reason.
Yeah, Linda.
Go ahead.
Do it.
Glenn is making this shocked face.
Go ahead.
Okay, I have to stand up for the sex scene in this movie because the entire premise of this movie has to be that Jennifer Lopez winds up being imperiled because she gives in to unbelievably amazing, incredible sex with this young man.
Mm-hmm.
For... that was Barry. That was not me.
That just escaped. I apologize.
In 95% of sex scenes in movies, it is what I would consider to be a man-oriented sex scene. And I am trying to say this in a family show kind of way.
I know what you're cooking.
But this is a sex scene that actually is very much centered around the way that women think about good sex, I think.
I am dying to see this movie now.
And I think that the movie is legitimately based around, in fact, the one thing that happens in 95% of sex scenes and that in 80% of sex scenes is the only thing that happens, I'm not sure it even happens in this sex scene. I mean, I think it happens in life, but I'm not sure that they show it in the movie.
I could listen to this all day. Please keep describing more of this sex scene.
This is a spin-off podcast. Linda describes J-Lo sex scene.
For Peach 13.
Oh, my God. It's amazing.
Okay, but the point I'm trying to make is, if you're going to make a sex thriller that makes the unusual decision to flip the genders of the people who are involved, because usually, despite what Steven says about a Lifetime movie, this kind of movie where the person has kind of somewhat illicit sex and then that person that they had it with immediately becomes crazy,
right,
is usually in Hollywood a movie about men.
Sure.
That is what it is in Fatal Attraction. That is mm-hmm. what it is in Disclosure. That is what it is in many other movies, because this is the model of the femme fatale. That's what this mm-hmm. is.
Right.
This kid, this young man in this movie is a male femme fatale. That's exactly
yeah. Yeah.
what he
okay.
is.
He's Alex, right?
And if you are going to flip that script and make a sex scene that is to Jennifer Lopez what the sex scene mm-hmm. in Fatal Attraction is to Michael Douglas, mm-hmm. it should be a different sex scene, and it is.
And what the scenes in many movies are with Michael Douglas.
But do you see what
yes,
I'm saying?
Yes,
I see what you're saying.
I give it credit for the fact that if you're going to center your movie around your sex scene to this degree, you have mm-hmm. to write it carefully. I can't believe how much time I just spent on that. But
no,
the point
so what
is,
you're saying
really
is that you loved
it.
The Boy Next Door. You found it was a sexy thriller with...
Can we spend a little bit more time on the sex scene? Let's do. Okay. So in this scene, because of a stipulation in Jennifer Lopez's contract...
You assume.
One assumes. Even though it's a rated R film, you don't see the rated R boobs.
That's
because
true.
The way it is filmed, he is clutching her chest in such a way as not so much to caress her breasts
no,
as to honk them.
He's like climbing.
He's like climbing
oh
up her butt.
All right, okay.
God.
Enough with the sex scene. It is a bad movie. The
dialogue
best,
the best
is
worst
terrible.
Stuff is in the trailer.
The dialogue is terrible. The story is ridiculous. And ultimately, it is actually, like all of these movies, incredibly Victorian in its morality.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Which
all
goes
moral
back
panic,
to
right.
home and hearth and mm-hmm. don't go mm-hmm. out and have indiscriminate sex because you will be punished
well, we were,
by
we were,
a crazy person showing up.
We were describing earlier today, you and me, Linda, we were comparing it to what I said about The Bachelor,
yeah.
about the Twin Towers of trashiness and moralism.
And that's very, very often in your very trashy entertainment, you find mm-hmm. an underlying traditional moralism. It's mm-hmm. an odd thing, but weirdly consistently true.
But the nice thing about the moral panic sex thriller, I mean, this is obviously not the movie you want to, you know, flip the script with. There were all of the Michael Douglas, the Basic Instincts, but that's how you got The Last Seduction. And mm-hmm. that is one of my favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a flip the script, not really flip the script, but that is a different kind of erotic thriller. And I think, I don't feel like we've had a bunch of erotic thrillers for a while. I mean, Gone
no.
Girl is the last time that there was a real sort of psychosexual, the gender politics of that are
complicated.
You know, are more complicated.
Right, of course. I mean, there have definitely been examples. I thought of and watched today, because my life is mm-hmm. excellent, the Beyonce and Idris Elba movie Obsessed, in which they are married to each other and there is a young blonde who begins coming on to him and he does not respond. She just becomes mm-hmm. crazily stalkery and then menaces them. And oh my gosh, if I could only watch one fist fight in a movie, Beyonce and Ali Larter in this movie does a good fight. And like,
right.
or like Swim Fan, like those like stalkery, obsessive, didn't
yeah.
think I was going to pull out Swim Fan,
but
yeah. There's a bunch of different ones, but I think this particular kind of morality play,
mm-hmm.
like you're talking about, yeah, I don't think we've had as many of those.
But slasher films, the classic horror slasher films are the ones in which the girl, well, anybody who has sex, dies.
Mm-hmm.
They die very phallically with a giant knife. Well, there's no horror films about people who chase people around with pills. It's always giant knife.
And if you've never seen Joss Whedon...
Cabin in the Woods.
Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of material about this.
So it just seems like those horror films are being a little bit more honest because the same mm-hmm. coded, you know, normative impulse here, which is let's punish the person who transgresses, is in these films. It's just in a different form. Maybe with sticking its pinky out, being a little bit more erudite.
Yeah, well, he does give her a first edition of the Iliad.
Yeah.
It's terrible, and yet, in a way, I watched it in a theater that I've recently discovered that has recliners as theater seats.
Sweet.
This is why we just put our finger on it. Remember, like, the second episode of this show where we were talking about Inception, and it was, like, it had been, like, 105 degrees outside,
uh-huh.
and the air conditioning had broken in my house,
yeah. Yeah.
and I was like, the movie theater was, like, 65 degrees, so I give this movie 11 billion stars.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I kind of feel
I think what we're getting at here.
Sitting there in this recliner in this big theater, just just watching this ridiculous movie. I didn't like it, but I responded to the experience of going.
So it was a stimulus that, like, you responded to.
Congratulations, Hollywood. I feel like what you're describing, if Jane the Virgin is pop culture comfort food, I feel like what you're describing is like that old chocolate bar, but there was still 3/4 of it left and you were starving.
And, like, yeah. And a bunch, like, of hair.
Like, exactly. And then you were like, ah! And then you ate it and you were like, that was kind of awesome.
But back me up here, Stephen. I don't want people going to this film based on what Linda has been describing.
This is not a camp class.
It is not campy. It is not over the top. It is not funny. It is not something you can really bask in. It's just a long...
No, it is fun to think about the erotic thriller because no matter what their gender politics are, like, I actually sort of love the erotic thriller. I'm glad to know this is not one I should see. I actually like Fatal Attraction a lot. I think it is a product of its time that's sort of important to think about.
It's very much a product of its time. It's very often in sex thrillers and in movies that draw this relationship between sex and violence and sex and death that you see expressions of whatever the current neurosis is.
Right.
Yeah.
And when it was Fatal Attraction, the current neurosis was working women.
Yeah.
And so you had this villainous working woman. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened in Disclosure a little bit later, where you had the sense that... This is, you know, Michael Douglas is being stalked by a series of businesswomen, you know?
Right.
And I think in this movie, what you get in this movie, I think, is the neurosis over the birth of the cougar, right?
Mm-hmm.
The birth of the older woman who is sexually liberated, perhaps after being married, and feels free to go and feel desirable and have sex with whoever she wants. And now that's what the neurosis is. The neurosis is...
Why are we neurotic?
But about you get
that?
To but you get to feel sorry. But from what you're describing with this film, you get to feel sorry for J-Lo.
Right.
Whereas the Adrienne Lynn version of the cougary wife who meets, you know, the hot French boyfriend, like, she's really punished for it.
Right. In the Michael Douglas movies, and particularly in Fatal Attraction, he's able to just go off and have illicit sex with Glenn Close, despite having this lovely wife at home who just is innocent and loves him. In this movie, I think in order to maintain sympathy for Jennifer Lopez, and I do think this is a gender issue, they have her have a bad husband. Otherwise, I think there is a concern that she would not be a sympathetic central figure if she just went off on a weekend and had sex with a 19-year-old.
Yeah, they make the kid 19 years old. Like, yeah. You know, so yeah, she's not technically committing a crime.
Yeah, it's a little unclear. She's a teacher. So.
She's a teacher, and he's, well, anyway. This movie does handle an interesting challenge. I mean, if you think about, like, older versions of, you know, psycho thrillers, the phone lines get cut. And how do you handle that challenge in the age of cell phones? And what this movie does is it gives her a cell phone, but renders her too stupid to call the cops for, like, more than an hour.
It's true.
I actually checked my phone. Like, look, what time is it they finally let her try to call the cops?
It's true.
And it's more than an hour into... anyway.
You'll find yourself looking at this movie saying, call the police, dummy. Call the police. No, it's true, but that's how this kind of movie is. Mm. All right. Well, again, if you have seen this movie, I would love to hear what you think of it. There are those of us who think that it could be worse. That's what I'll say.
That person's name is Linda Holmes.
And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I am tentatively happy about the recent announcement of 2 upcoming albums. And I say tentatively because they're both the kind of project that can often go wildly off the rails. They're both tributes to tragic cult singers, whom I love dearly. And both singers who are being paid tribute to are the types where covers don't always do it for me because you're taking away the beauty and intimacy of these voices. But I say I'm tentatively excited because I love the artists involved in all sides of these equations. One of them is called Seth Avitt and Jessica Lee Mayfield Sing Elliott Smith.
Oh, okay.
Seth Avitt from the Avitt Brothers, a band that Linda and I both love. Jessica Lee Mayfield, who's a very, very good singer-songwriter. They are tackling the songs of Elliott Smith. I don't think ever fully hooked into an Elliott Smith cover. Elliott Smith, kind of like Nick Drake, they're both these very soft singers who people cover by singing softly without actually getting to the pain right. and getting to the nuance that make his music different from the music of other sad, wispy singer-songwriter dudes. So I feel like in their hands, that could work. I have not heard it yet. I've heard one song. It's nice. I hold out hope. The other one is one I almost can't believe exists. It is a 5-song EP coming out the same day, March 17th. Both albums are coming out the same day, called It Was Triumph We Once Proposed, Songs of Jason Molina. I've talked about Jason Molina on this show a number of times. Jason Molina songs performed by Glenn Hansard.
Oh my gosh.
And so...
created for Stephen Thompson.
It is kind of like Eve Barzelay collaborates with the ghost of Jeff Buckley, you know, from a standpoint of I kind of can't believe that these two things I love are coming together. Now, Glenn Hansard and Jason Molina were friends. Before Molina died, I worked on a little piece for Morning Edition about his music where I interviewed Glenn mm-hmm. Hansard, where he talked about how much he loved his music. It's not necessarily a surprise. I've heard one of the 5 songs. It's very nice. So it's just, I guess what's making me happy is these singers whose music I love having their songs tackled by people I trust.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That sounds very promising indeed. Thank you, Stephen Thompson.
You.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. Wet Hot American Summer is coming back this summer on Netflix as a limited series, again, on Netflix. The teaser trailer dropped today, and it doesn't tell you anything. All it does is it zooms in on a cabin at a summer camp, but the names of the cast come up. You're just kind of like, but what about Joe Latrullio? But what about David Hyde Pierce? But what about Chris Maloney? And they're all in it. I'm in. That'll be this summer. Second thing, Gallivant. Now, Gallivant is a 4-week, 8-episode miniseries that concluded last Sunday night. It was on ABC. The subject and the sensibility, the best way to describe it, a very generous way to describe it, is Princess Bride the Musical. The songs are by Alan Menken and Glenn Slater. The whole thing is produced by Dan Fogelman. Now, that's the team, or at least part of the team, that brought us Tangled. So it's not as charming as Princess Bride, but it is sweatier. The jokes try harder. And man, it's good. But if these jokes landed just 15 to 20% lighter and came at you 15 to 20% faster, it'd be great. But it is good. And there's Timothy Amundsen plays a king who's a lot of fun on the show. Does he say things like for realsies? Yeah. And you kind of wish he didn't. You kind of wish that joke.
It's a little bit you to aunt.
Just going to say it's you to aunt.
It's totally you to aunt. It's like one of these things that was dated in the writer's room when it was pitched 2 years ago and still, and it's going to keep this thing from being as timeless as I think it could potentially be. Hugh Bonneville, who plays Lord Grantham on Downton Abbey. And on that show for the past, in this new season, he is just acting like a total jerk. And so it's kind of nice to see him light and do a little song. It's a lot of fun. Good, not great. It's available, you know, streaming and downloadable, etc.
And Weird Al is in that, right?
And Weird Al, of course, is in it. Yep.
All right. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
So two things. Cautiously, Togetherness, which I've only seen, I guess we've seen now 3 episodes, which is the HBO show that is sandwiched between Girls and Looking. Melanie Lynskey is, I haven't seen her since, or I feel like I haven't really run across her since she was in the Heavenly Creatures with
Kate Winslet. She's worked a ton.
And I know she's done a ton, everything. But that's the last thing that I sort of remember, and I couldn't believe it was the same person. I feel like she's doing such a wonderful job with this part, which is this very, very sort of insular woman going through this moment in her life when she has 2 kids and her sex life is a little freaky, or she is sort of not happening with her husband, and she's sort of looking outside herself in a way that seems so real and is so sort of tender. I'm cautiously very optimistic about this show because it's nice to see her on TV doing this part so beautifully. And then the other thing, I just want to recommend one specific episode of Marc Maron. So there was a 2-hour conversation with Mike Judge from a couple of weeks ago that I finally sat down to listen to. And it was absolutely fascinating, especially as a person that, you know, there is Mike Judge stuff that I really like. You know, I liked King of the Hill quite a bit. I watched Silicon Valley and there's much to like about it. But, you know, like I'm not an Office Space devotee. I recognize that Beavis and Butthead was a thing, but it wasn't my thing. He was such a fascinating person to listen to.
Yeah, his take on what went wrong with Idiocracy, a film that I love, is just so smart and insightful, and he actually gets it right. He nails it, actually.
Yeah, and gentle. Like, he's what a gentle, interesting soul. I really, big fan.
Thank you, Barry Hardiman. Okay, what is making me happy this week? I got quick hits.
I am currently reading my e-galley of The Royal We, which is the new upcoming novel from the Fug Girls. Yay. You may know them, Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan, who have written a couple of novels previously that were YA novels. This is an adult novel. It is sort of their fantasy spun off of the idea of Prince William and Kate Middleton. It is not about them. It is not fanfic, but it is sort of inspired by all of the thoughts that they have about, wouldn't it be great if their story was this? It's a lot of fun so far. The episode, last week's episode of This American Life, was about online comments, which to me, when major outlets get into, let's talk about online comments, I tend to back away. This leads with a long piece from Lindy West, a very well-known writer from Jezebel and The Guardian and a bunch of other places. And Lindy is someone who has received a tremendous amount of harassment and trolling online and goes and actually speaks to the guy who was responsible for one particular very shocking piece of internet trolling. And they have quite a remarkable conversation. And then there's also a thing about Vocal Fry. Please listen to the thing about Vocal Fry. The thing that I learned at the SAG Awards was that Felicity Huffman's nickname is Flicka, which is the best thing I have ever heard, maybe ever.
Yep.
When her husband, William H. Macy, addressed her as Flicka, my heart grew three sizes. I got to talk about Parks and Recreation on the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC last week with William Henry Harrison expert Gail Collins of the New York Times. Aww. Maybe the most public radio thing anyone has ever done in the history of public radio, and it was an incredible amount of fun. And finally, to return to something that Glenn and I have both talked about a lot, last week's episode of Judge John Hodgman involves a guy who wants to create an entire room in his house dedicated to Frozen. It is one of their really delightful, awesome episodes. They bring in Kristen Anderson Lopez and Bobby Lopez, who wrote the music in Frozen.
Who inflicted Frozen upon us.
Who come in and have lots to say, she in particular, about this entire idea of decorating a Frozen room in your house. There's just a lot of giggling, and it's very good-natured, but it also comes from this place of these guys whose house it is really love each other. It's just that one of them is not so into having an entire Frozen room. I absolutely adored it. Okay, and there's one more thing that is making me happy this week, which you have already heard about, but which we are reminding you of. On February 17th, we have a live event here at NPR. We're going to tape our Oscars Omnibus, which if you listen to the show, you're familiar with that episode that we do every year. We will be with our friend Bob Mondello. It is a pretty simple show. It's a little stripped down from our usual extravaganzas, but that means, you know, everybody gets home a little bit earlier. The tickets are a little cheaper. We got $15, and that's it. It's just $15. So for $15, you can come and watch us tape the show with Bob. The tickets for that are going to go on sale at events.npr.org, and that's on February 3rd at noon. Now, history suggests if you want to get a ticket, make sure that you are prompt in looking. Again, the event is on February 17th. The tickets will go on sale February 3rd at noon Eastern time. So that is the last thing. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. Follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman, that's BHARDYMON. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you may very well be tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, your guide to what's good in pop culture. Every week, Jesse Thorne interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at iTunes under Podcasts.